Good evening, Lords, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Jane Sinclair. I'm one of the canons here at Westminster Abbey, and I chair the Westminster Abbey Institute. So on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome, I mean that from the heart rather than the atmosphere, a warm welcome to the Lady Chapel. It's got three names, this chapel. The Lady Chapel, because it's dedicated in honour of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the Mother of Jesus. Sometimes it's known as the Henry VII Chapel. He and his wife, Elizabeth of York, are buried just behind the altar here. Or the Chapel of the Order of the Bath, which explains why we have all these banners and sort of regalia around the chapel. The Westminster Abbey Institute was founded to nurture moral and spiritual values in public life and service. And so in its spring programme, just entitled Truth, we're seeking to explore and defend the place of truth in public life. I'm delighted to welcome Lord Judge, who's a member of the Institute's Council of Reference, and whose biography, along with that of Claire Foster Gilbert, our speaker. Their biographies are on your seat, so do, if you're sitting on it, I mean, do hoik them out and have a look. But I'm going to say no more other than to ask Igor now to take over as our chair for this evening. Igor.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'll start by asking you to have a warm round of applause, because tonight is the first occasion when tonight's speaker, Claire Foster Gilbert, can fully and properly and in her own right be introduced to you as Dr. Foster Gilbert. What is remarkable is that what she has to say to you tonight will have nothing whatever to do with the distinction in which she earned her academic qualification. That'll be for another day. Please do read the life biography of Claire Foster Gilbert, as it's there before you. That will avoid me taking up unnecessary time reading it out. This Dr. Foster Gilbert is one of the outstanding public moral philosophers in this country. It is very apt that she is speaking here in this chapel. But beyond the philosophizing, the thinking, I have to introduce someone to you as a woman of action. You see, the Westminster Abbey Institute is a fantastic organization. I could talk to you about that for a long time. But Claire is the founding director. And in the 5 years since the Institute was founded, she has been energetic, passionate, committed, inspirational, particularly to the young fellows who have joined us. And so tonight, as she reflects on this burning question of truth in a fake news age, you can also reflect when your minds are just wandering slightly. She's a woman of action and will spot that my attention has drifted. So I can assure you, your attention will not drift. This is an issue of such huge importance to the way in which we see ourselves as a country. Truth. The five lectures in this series, Truth and Beauty, Truth Enough, Lies, Diplomacy and Politics, Truth Pursued, Truth Sustained, and tonight the last in the series, Truth Told, encapsulate something about the necessity of integrity and honesty in public life. It is a subject about which every nation should be speaking to itself, and without the truth to which Dr. Foster Gilbert is going to refer, I personally do not believe that a nation can be entirely at peace with itself. Of course, it's easy. We were all brought up to tell the truth, and our mummies and daddies could tell us straight away when we weren't telling the truth. I can remember an occasion when I denied that I'd been licking the jelly out of my mother's jelly bowl. I really loved the liquid jelly much more than I liked the finished product. And I still remember denying it, and she pointed out... Very well. Enough of me and my life, Dr. Foster Gilbert.
my lords, ladies, and gentlemen. What is it that poisons our social life? What is it that spoils even the holy season that lies before us? It is deceit. It is untruthfulness. Let each one of us decide here and now, for this season at least, to cast aside all deceit and hypocrisy and speak the truth one with another. It will be the first step in a holier life. It will make this time the happiest of our lives. Following in the illustrious footsteps of the speakers of the previous 2 weeks, I offer a literary allusion to support the thesis of my lecture this week on telling the truth. My esteemed colleagues Vernon White and Stephen Lamport gave you Ian McEwan, Anthony Trollope, Arthur Kessler, and George Orwell. In turn, I give you a woman of great note, Richmal Crompton, whose famous protagonist, known the world over as Just William, struggled with truth. The exhortation with which I began my lecture is taken from the vicar's sermon given the Sunday before Christmas in the story William's Truthful Christmas. Indulge my further telling of the story. For once, not tormenting the curate by staring at him unblinkingly, or accidentally letting his stag beetle escape from its matchbox and make its way up his sister's arm to her neck, William heard what the vicar said, and the words made a deep impression on him. He decided to cast aside all deceit and hypocrisy and speak the truth, at least on Christmas Day. Christmas Day dawned. After the presents had been opened, William's aunt thanked him for the pincushion he had given her. True to his resolution, William explained carefully that it was left over from Mother's stall at the sale of work. And Mother said it was no use keeping it for next year because it had got so faded. William was equally careful to explain to his uncle that his present, a leather purse, was a birthday gift discarded by his father because the catch didn't work. When Lady Atkinson arrived, one of the Atkinsons, you know, whispered Aunt Emma, she gave as her present to the family a signed photograph of herself. There were murmurs of surprise and admiration and gratitude from the adults. But William, when asked what he thought of it, replied that the photographic image was not as fat as you are. His parents protested at his impoliteness. Impolite, said William, with some indignation. I'm not trying to be polite. I'm being truthful. I can't be everything. Seems to me I'm the only person in the world who is truthful, and no one seems to be grateful to me. It isn't as fat as what she is, he went on doggedly, and it's not got as many little lines on its face as what she has, and it's different looking altogether. It looks pretty, and she doesn't. Lady Atkinson stormed out, and the fury of the family turned upon William, inexplicably to him, while his uncle, equally inexplicably, slipped him half a crown. My lecture this evening is in 2 parts. First, I will explore how thankless a task telling the truth in public life can be, how hard a task, how much circumstances prevail against its being told. Second, I will suggest that our truth-telling is like a muscle that needs to be exercised, or it atrophies, and offer, with the humility of one who frequently fails to attend the moral gym, some exercises to help keep the muscles supple and in good shape. Let us begin with politics, speaking truth in power. Politicians start with a very great disability in this regard, for they have always been thought of as liars. All the way back to the 16th century, Shakespeare had a multitude of insults for politicians, such as Lear's advice to the blinded Gloucester to get thee glass eyes, and like a scurvy politician, seem to see the things thou dost not. We probably laugh with, rather than challenge, E.E. Cummings' more recent suggestion that a politician is an ass upon which everyone has sat except a man. It is notable how even people who are genuinely politically engaged and supportive of democracy often make strong generalizations such as, they're all in it for themselves, and you can never trust a politician, or simply laugh out loud when I tell them I run an institute for ethics in public life. Ipsos Mori bears out my experience. In 2019, its veracity index had politicians at the bottom of every list of professionals whom we do, or rather don't, trust. Lower than estate agents and a lot lower than lawyers. The top five most trusted professionals are doctors, teachers, judges, scientists, and hairdressers. In the face of such a sustained assumption that one's trustworthiness, in the face of such a sustained assumption about one's untrustworthiness, how easy is it to adhere to the truth? How would any of us feel if we were consistently not believed, no matter what we said? How soon would we give up and simply, for ease, say the things that serve to ensure our re-election? In other words, revert to a default setting of weak people pleaser. The pressure not to tell the truth is increased by a further complication related to our other attitude to politicians alongside our mistrust, and that is our childish wish that they would make everything all right. Another Ipsos Mori poll, commissioned by King's College London, reported 60% of us believing that we expect more of our government than we do of God. So on the one hand, we have no faith in our politicians, and on the other, we want them to be more powerful than the Almighty. This glorious inconsistency of the human heart is resonant, I suggest, with the way we view our parents. Our childhood lasts as long as they seem all-powerful to us and ends on the day we learn they have feet of clay. Most young people then have to go through a desperately painful period of adolescent hatred and rejection as they readjust to a world in which they cannot simply leave it to their parents to make it all right, but have to start on the long journey of adult responsibility. But with us, the electorate, and our politicians, it seems, instead of passing through the rejection period and into responsible adulthood, we are stuck in a cycle where at election time we return again and again to our infant state of wanting them to make it all right for us and having voted them in, hating them when they don't. There was a phenomenon called Clegg mania in 2010, which swiftly turned to Clegg phobia once Clegg found himself part of government and forced by circumstances to renege on previously made promises. Without a shadow of a doubt, if Corbyn had won the May 2017 election and become Prime Minister, he would have met with the same callous fate. Corbyn mania would have curdled to Corbyn loathing as he struggled to deal with the overwhelming demands of Brexit and faced compromise after compromise of his party's dreams for us all. For most of what a government has to deal with when in power comes from external forces beyond its power, and with the best will in the world can only struggle to implement some of its manifesto promises, while having to attend to events, dear boy, events, as they roll towards it in relentless waves. I suppose we all, including politicians, harbour a secret hope that someone will make it all right. Most people enter politics because they want to make a difference. But given the fact that no matter what you say, people will swing from calling you Messiah to calling you a scurvy fake, which politician is going to campaign on a ticket of promising to try hard not to fail too much? And like Just William's family, who among her colleagues is going to thank her for such honesty? Politically independent parts of our constitution are required, by means of their neutrality, to tell truth to power. These are the civil service, the judiciary, and the uniformed and other security services. The civil service brings into being policies determined by democratically elected ministers. The values of civil servants, then, are bureaucratic. They must make the policies work, whatever they are, unless, and this is critical, the policies are balmy. That is to say, it is not possible to implement them without some form of unacceptable harm. The civil servant's word for balmy, incidentally, is brave. The intention is that the civil servant will have recourse to empirical evidence and objective knowledge in order to make the minister's wishes come true, or say so if they cannot be. But civil servants are not automata. They, like the rest of us, have particular perspectives and beliefs and emotional commitments, any of which could influence their interpretation of the facts, however determined they are to set them to one side. Civil servants might say to a minister in all conscience that a policy may not be possible, and the minister simply doesn't accept their advice. The minister might say, "Find me someone who does believe that this can be done." Is the civil servant to step aside? Is the question one of talent or perception or belief rather than truth? What is happening psychologically here? Do civil servants, on the grounds that truth will always be partial, do everything to please the minister, because, after all, the minister might be right? Or do civil servants stick their heels in and assert themselves? The threat to truth for the civil servant comes in the form of overconfidence, or equally underconfidence, in the force of their arguments. A recently published report on the civil service by Andrew Kakabadze demonstrates that sometimes the pressure on civil servants to shy away from telling the truth is considerable, where not to do so, thereby infuriating their minister, would be career-destroying. But if they do shy away, the ones who pay the price are the frontline staff who have to implement balmy policies, often too quickly, and face the uncomprehending fury of the public, who cannot understand how something could have been foisted upon them that is so unthought through. I fear Brexit is bringing these pressures to bear more fiercely and uncomfortably than this generation has ever seen before. Telling the truth is indeed a thankless task for the executive as they attempt the complex task of unpicking 43 years of relationship and regulation without doing too much damage to the country. The judiciary is protected from the morally corrosive forces that attend upon having to seek election. The cost is that the people do not choose their judges, even indirectly, and so responsibility falls upon judges to ensure that their judgments are just, faithful to the facts of the case, and attentive to the balance of the arguments put to them, in order to honour the power they have been given. They, above all, must guard against unconscious bias. Being aware that one might be unconsciously biased is not enough. Active steps have to be taken to prevent it. But asking judges to undergo such training does not always win their gratitude. Recognizing the effect of unconscious bias on perception, the police have consciously shifted towards a policy of believing victims who come to them, particularly in the case of victims of sexual and domestic crimes. Clarity and truth are hard to establish in the fraught hinterland of domestic violence, where women and children have not only not been believed by others, but have also not trusted themselves, harbouring devastating and confounding notions of responsibility for their abuse. But simply assuming the victim has been abused has other consequences, most of all for the fairness of the trial of the accused perpetrator, who is thereby not assumed innocent until proven guilty. Frontline police have to act swiftly in circumstances that are tortuously complex. In one fraught scene to which an officer might be called, social and emotional, economic deprivation, histories of abuse, mental health difficulties, gang pressure, racial and religious hatred could all be among the presenting issues. They would keep a moral philosopher in food for thought for a decade. The police officer does not have that luxury. She must decide in the moment what is the right course of action, with sufficient assurance to win the confidence of the public, who complicate matters further by their presence on the scene. The armed and security forces usually, though not always, operate within a more controlled theatre of conflict or espionage, and so do not have the pressure of a messy public presence. Like civil servants, their tasks are set by their political masters, but they have operational independence. On the front line, there is no scrutinising body, so how do the forces ensure they see the circumstances clearly, respond with integrity, and report back faithfully so that future policy decisions on security matters are educated by true experience? Sometimes the armed forces do have a scrutinising presence in the theatre of war, known as embeds, journalists who accompany them on their tours of duty and, embedded with them, see all that they see. Journalists are public servants too, though they are not always thought of as such. Their role is to tell the truth about those in power. Journalists are free to speak in this country, and the freedom that they have is precisely the freedom to tell the truth. Lying is for a censored press. The value of a free press cannot be overstated. It is an absolutely essential characteristic of a civilized society. By means of our free press, government, business, and the activities of foreign powers can be called to account without fear of reprisal. We may loathe the crude headlines and bemoan the lack of accuracy, but suppose our press was prevented by our government from creating them. Imagine reading a news story that you knew had been censored or even generated by the government. How soon would you start to mistrust the government? The odd irony is that our trust such as it is, arises precisely because the government allows itself to be criticised, often unfairly, in the press. And yet our assumption can be that we mistrust the government because of the media's reporting. So for a journalist, the crime of telling a story that is too good to check far, far outweighs the damage that might be done to reputations by reporting truthfully. And that is the challenge to the journalist, not to be beguiled into weaving a better narrative than the one that is tied to the facts, because we all love a good story. Contrary to appearances, social media does not make journalists of us all. We do not all have the journalist's skill of seeking out the truth and telling the story clearly and well. Nor do we have the inclination. We are rubbish at telling each other the truth online. As ill-educated opinions flood the ether and untrue stories travel 70% more quickly than true ones, as a recent study found, journalists, real ones, are needed more than ever. In the world of journalism, fake news is a logical impossibility. If it's fake, it isn't journalism. Science and the arts are two areas of life which can and should be drivers for the truth. They are forms of public service at the deepest level, finding and setting cultural norms, generating ways of seeing the world which we all, knowingly or unknowingly, adopt. In the world of science, there are two strong biases that tempt the scientist away from telling the truth. The first, recognized by Karl Popper and by good civil servants, is that once you have generated a hypothesis, it is nearly impossible not to see it demonstrated in the data around you. Popper urges scientists, once they have articulated their hypotheses, then, to construct experiments which seek consciously to disprove them. In his autobiography, Charles Darwin describes the great dismay of his companion on a geological field trip when Darwin found a tropical fossil that appeared to disprove all that geology knew about the superficial deposits of the Midland counties. Safe assumptions were being overturned, and arguably it took a great scientist like Darwin, open to new explanations, to see what was there. His companion would not have found that fossil, I contend. He simply would not have seen it because he wasn't looking for anything beyond what he believed to be true. Was anyone as surprised as I was to discover that the author of the Just William books was a woman called Richmoll, not a man called Richard? I swear I have seen the front cover of the William books and read Richard, where the print clearly says, and has always said, Richmoll. The second pressure against the truth is from what we might call the burden of the anomalous experiment. Nobel laureate Sir Paul Nurse tells a story of the experiments he ran to test a hypothesis he had generated in his early days as a research scientist. He ran his experiments over and over again, and the results consistently neither proved nor disproved his hypothesis, but demonstrated an anomaly he could not explain. Paul had a young family and a mortgage. By the system of ranking of universities and the way in which professional academic careers are judged, scientists, all academics, are under enormous pressure to publish. Paul sat contemplating the failure of his experiment with, as he describes it, an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other. The devil reminded him that only he had seen these results, that he could fudge them and publish in a second-rate journal, that he would never be offered a job without a publication, that without a job his mortgager would foreclose and his babies would starve. Above all, no one but he, Paul, knew the truth of his experiments. The angel, sitting on his other shoulder, told him that he was a scientist, that his duty was to tell the truth about the experiments that had failed, even though it meant he would not be published, he would not be offered a job, his mortgager would foreclose, and his babies would starve. Paul found a third way, the most truthful way of all, which was to accept the anomaly that the experiments showed. That choice led him to further research, culminating in his Nobel Prize for his contribution to cancer treatment. So the story ends well for him and for humanity. But he wasn't to know that as a young and burdened scientist on his own in the laboratory with no one to check up on him and only his own conscience to attend to. So we deeply rely upon our scientists to honour the truth, to run properly designed experiments, and to be open to new possibilities. But where do these hypotheses come from? Made famous by Archimedes' cry of, "Eureka! I have found it!" A scientist's eureka moment comes when she sees what has not been seen before. And here, she is helped by the artist. For the arts, telling the truth must involve being open to that which is beyond calculation or ordinary rationality. The artist, above all, should reach to articulate what has not yet been seen, to point to hitherto unimagined possibilities, and hence to be the most open of us all to the chaotic and the unknown. Here, perhaps, with the mystic, the artist must empty herself of all that stands in the way of simply seeing, precisely because she has been granted the gift of expressing or pointing towards the truthful, the unknown, and the new. Truth, then, is something we have to actively work towards in our different fields, not something that we can ever take for granted. It requires an effortful discernment and courageous intention against forces of inertia and complacency. It is like a muscle that, without exercise, atrophies. But using it can be risky, lonely, and often apparently inadvisable on utilitarian grounds. Like Just William's family, most of us cannot bear too much reality. I am as culpable as the next person with regard to telling the truth. I often lie, wittingly or unwittingly, and I am as prone as any to go with the flow of groupthink, as the Chilcot report called it. So I speak now in the spirit of one fallible soul to another, offering some thoughts on how to cultivate truth-telling, on what exercises, as it were, our sessions in the moral gym might include. With regard to making policies, I wish we could all, government and people alike, learn from scientists and cultivate a research mentality. Medicine has learned, particularly over the last half century, to be methodical in its approach, developing treatments theoretically, then testing them in the laboratory, then on a few healthy human beings, then on those who have the condition the treatment is intended for, and not granting a license to market the treatment until enough research has been done to justify such a decisive step. What if policies were to be developed with that same spirit of discovery, rather than with the pressure of having to find solutions straight away to problems we may have inadequately identified in the first place? It's a tall order, and I can immediately think of lots of reasons why it would be difficult, but the mentality that allows government to learn and society to evolve from trial and error would be a fitting alternative to a government of false promises and an infantilized electorate. And what else is the digital revolution for if not to facilitate such an approach? Importantly, there is an existing, robust ethical framework from medical research to learn from. This interrogates the moral desirability of the aims of the research, how it is to be carried out, and the way in which patient groups invested in the outcome of the research actively contribute to its design and are not merely guinea pigs. How much harder, of course, for a minister to have to wait until what would be the equivalent of the licensing moment before announcing a new policy response, but how great the prize when the announcement would be actually true rather than a hopeful promise. Our moral exercise here, then, is to cultivate a mindset that is always open to new learning and to the hitherto unknown or unthought of. The research mindset is of necessity a humble one. Humility is a critical but countercultural skill for people in public office. In our Fellows programme, we include a session on facing fallibility, in which we give ourselves permission and the opportunity to connect at a deep level with the things inside us that make us ashamed or fearful. We use an imaginative Ignatian technique in which we feel our way to our places of desolation, as you might feel with your hand along a wall, having woken up in complete darkness, not knowing where you are. Completely blind, your fingers' connection with the wall is your only guide until they find a light switch. Switch on the light, and you can see the doorway out. The walls are our limitations, and they are needed creatively to find our liberation. Our weakness is where our strength is to be found, but it has to be acknowledged, not suppressed. This discernment process is the opposite of achievement and superiority, and it is strangely joyful. We discover that our deepest fears are the dragons guarding our greatest treasures. Acknowledging our fallibility means acknowledging we need help. This, in turn, can force us to seek good company, those who believe that telling the truth is important and will hold us to it, people whom we love and respect and whom we would let down if we failed to try to adhere to truthfulness. Then we have to ensure we are in the company of those who challenge our suppositions. It is no good if you are in public office, surrounding yourself with those who agree with you. The story of J.F. Kennedy taking on his own devil's advocate, who was to be present at all his meetings and deliberately disagree with him, is a fine one, whether it is true or not. A contemporary manifestation of the devil's advocate is the Chilcot person, whose role is to challenge groupthink. An important benefit of this exercise of welcoming the diverse voice is that it helps us to cultivate indifference, so that we are not too quickly loyal to a point of view. The one who cultivates indifference sees most clearly because she is not compelled. This indifference is an active state, like keeping one's balance. It is not a default state. Neutrality never is. Let me offer you an example of one who takes her moral and spiritual health as seriously as she does her physical health. Even when she was at the height of her seniority and had the fullest life imaginable as a cabinet minister, constituency MP, and family woman, every year Tessa Jarl spent a week in a remote monastery in silent retreat. This brought her to her own essential self, its fallibility and its strength, and gave her space to listen to, in her case, God. Anyone who has done this in good faith will know that the exercise is a million miles from the assumption behind crude questions to politicians about whether God told them to do something. The discernment of movement of spirit is a tender, vulnerable thing and should not be exposed too quickly to the electric light of publicity. Tessa Giles spent a second week each year in a place of the greatest deprivation she could find. For example, the jungle refugee camp in Calais or the Dharavi slum in Mumbai. Facing the worst deprivation in the world put everything else in perspective and gave Tessa a proper sense of her relatively insignificant, but nevertheless important, place in the scheme of things. Telling the truth for most of us means, above all, the use of words. Thank heavens we have raised voices rather than raised fists, as Peter Hennessy put it in our recent publication, The Moral Heart of Public Service. One of my favourite books, discovered as a child and still treasured, is Gerald Durrell's The Talking Parcel. Parrot, a character in the book, is the keeper of the dictionaries. His job is to keep words alive, and they only stay alive if they are used. So every year he would read every word in the dictionaries out aloud. But since one outing a year wasn't much to live on, he would use as varied and rich a vocabulary as he could for all the rest of the time, so the poor darlings went out as much as possible. Never use get, got, nice or terrible, my superb English teacher taught me at primary school. Grammar clarifies, as you have to be clear what is the subject, what is the verb, and what is the object of each sentence. A paragraph is a unit of writing, as Harold Evans taught, not a sentence and certainly not a tweet. A paragraph should be beautifully formed around a single point, explaining, justifying, and supporting it. The exception is the pithy saying or apothem. But these are rare indeed, the product of a fine-tuned mind. Wouldn't it be wonderful if all our tweets were of such calibre? There would only be one or two a year. Truth is not just found in the words themselves or the way they are framed. It is found in the cadences of speech, the poetic effect, the tone. As a barrister teacher of advocacy told me, the money is down here. I believe I succeeded in persuading all 120 bishops of the Church of England that the environment was to be taken seriously because I changed the tone of voice in which they were spoken to on the subject, from a whine and a moan to something a touch more charming. And indeed, communication researchers will say that more than two-thirds of my communication to you this evening is visual, around 20% is how I sound, and only about 3% of what I say will reach you. So much. And sometimes, silence is the best form of truth of all. I emphatically do not mean the silence which amounts to collusion. Indeed, that tells its own truth. It is a matter of some considerable pride that some visitors see noisy demonstrators against the atrocities of their regimes on our streets, restrained, yes, but also protected and not silenced by our police, as with the recent visit of the Saudi prince, where a vocal group set itself up opposite Downing Street and loudly demanded a stop to the war in Yemen, and our own LGBT demonstrators outside Westminster Abbey at the time of the Commonwealth celebration, protesting against abuse in some Commonwealth countries. The silence I mean is revelatory silence, as we give ourselves the chance to rest from our busy lives, to stop, and, as Pablo Neruda puts it, look at our hurt hands, to give to our overused, soiled, and toiling earth a rest. This is the silence within which the truth might emerge. So I am going to finish this lecture and our spring program with silence. We are in a holy place. Its walls have heard the prayers of people like us for hundreds of years, people seeking understanding, wisdom, peace, justice, truth. We are once again in troubled times. The burden of public office is heavy. It is easy to be despondent. We can draw strength from the listening silence of this place and the good company we are in tonight. So, I will count to 12, and you will keep quiet, and then we'll speak again. Thank you very much.
I'm not sure I want to break the silence. Now I'm making a serious point. But our speaker is very happy to try and answer questions. So if you have questions arising from the issues which have been discussed tonight, please would you raise a hand, and then a microphone will be handed to you, and then please ask a question. So where shall we begin? Let's start with the back of the class. The back of the class, sort of trying, like just William, not trying to draw attention to themselves, but wondering about the stag beetle going up his sister's arm. No questions from there. All right. Any questions, please?
You have to stand up and say who you are.
Sorry?
Would you mind standing up? Say who you are. Actually, I'm sure you can hear Mr. Rowley. Go on, ask your question.
Mark Rowley.
Yes, do please do pass them. Because we're filming.
Police officer from Scotland Yard for 4 more hours. That was fantastic, Claire. Thank you very much. You touched on the police, and I'd agree with your challenge about believing one particular side and the point you made there. My question was going to be about public debate, and as public leaders, we seem to be in a time when public debate is people less and less worry about the facts. There's something about being drowned in information where almost whatever people want to believe to be the truth can be, and that makes it very difficult as a leader, whether accounting for your own services publicly or whether dealing with politicians who are being blown around in this wind of opinion rather than evidence. Do you have any thoughts on that context and how we tackle that better?
Thank you. Perhaps the internet age has flooded us with many, 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 many facts. What you mentioned makes me think of a point that's been made in this very recent business about Cambridge Analytica using data, or taking data, and taking data with permission, as they said, and then from Facebook, and then it being used to influence elections. The reason they can say they used it with permission is that the terms and conditions in the, when people did downloaded a certain app included that this information will be passed on, or there was something in the terms and conditions. And I don't know about you, but I never read terms and conditions because they're so long. And something in me thinks I've got to trust the provider that if I tick terms and conditions and can go forward with whatever app it is that I'm, or facility it is that I'm downloading, that they're not misleading me in any way. Well, silly me, but who's going to read all those terms and conditions? Jack Straw, in this series, said, when you've done something wrong, he said, the thing is to confess immediately, but confess absolutely everything. And he said, what would happen is you go onto the floor of the house and you confess to whatever it was that you'd done, along with absolutely every detail about the event, and people would just die of boredom and just stop being cross with you. So this is his method, which is entirely truthful. But I suppose the real challenge for someone who is trying to communicate from whatever position, and particularly from a position of responsibility, is to choose facts. Not choose facts in order for it to be misleading, but choose facts in order to communicate as truthfully as possible. Not to play fast and loose with this pouring out of information that we have. I suppose the amount of information has somehow downgraded what a fact is, but really a fact should be treated as something of tremendous value, because we can all have opinions, but a fact, that glass on that table, it's something we can settle with and gather around, even if we all see it slightly differently, as the police would know only too well by taking witness statements. So choose facts. It means taking time, though, and that's something that people in public office don't have. I think what I really want to say from where I'm standing, and perhaps it's easy for me to do this, is to say it's so important, make the time.
Thank you. Yes. Francis, you come first. I'll get you first. Up here, please. And I saw him raise this. You come next.
Thank you so much. A lot of food for thought. I want to go back to your example about the civil servant who has to tell the minister that his idea is balmy. I'm Francis D'Souza. That's a very difficult thing to do, and it reminds me of a very dear friend of mine who, at the time of the Iraq War, actually resigned from the Foreign Office. He was a up-and-coming diplomat. He was one of two people who resigned from the Foreign Office because they believed so strongly that the evidence was not available and it was going against UN resolutions. And his life has been an unbelievable struggle since then. Not in his personal life, but in simply being...
that you feel you ought to have said but haven't, because it shames you as well. And I wonder whether the conclusion to that is that anyone who is really hell-bent on speaking truth unto themselves and to power shouldn't go into the civil service.
But what a council of despair that is.
Yeah.
We cannot surrender to that thought. We cannot. The whole heart of the civil service is truthfulness, it seems to me. That's the point of the political neutrality. Oh, my goodness, think of other countries around the world. You've got someone sitting next to you who comes from a different administration where there is endemic corruption. That's fair to say. And what a terrible thing that would be. We in this room tonight have to believe and support truth-telling wherever we see it for that reason. We cannot have that kind of moral cowardice that's going to say, to step back from the person who had the courage to tell the truth and not stand with them, and indeed to try and do it ourselves. But in a sense, the point about going to the moral gym, this is the serious point. You have to practice against the time of trial, so that there is that strength and resilience within you, and you are in good company. There are people around you who will support you in your endeavour to be true to truthfulness.
Yes. Yes, please.
It's not working.
Would you mind standing up so everybody can hear?
Thank you very much indeed. On the subject of the conflict between taking time and taking action, I mean, I very much heard you on the benefit of medical research that takes as long as it needs before policy and action taken. But you also mentioned Chilcot, and I suddenly thought of Grenfell, and it does seem to many people that we take too long to find the truth. Are there some issues, and would you include environment and global warming crisis, where actually it takes so long to find the whole truth that we have to take action before?
Well, in the case of the environmental situation, I think we have enough evidence. There really is no need to hesitate now, and indeed we've agreed not to hesitate. So, and also the Chilcot report, the Grenfell Tower inquiry, these things are taking time there after the event. The idea of the research model is that you do your research before the event so that these sorts of mistakes are less likely to be made, that we learn as we go along. The policies are implemented as we go in a learning context rather than in a paradigm of some suggestion that they're solutions. There's some finality about the policy. So yes, those reviews that take a long time happen after the event, and maybe they do need to take that length of time. I suppose for action to change, you thinking about action to change after?
I mean, there's still a dispute after all. The problem in the USA is people who
are denying it. Oh, yeah. So the facts are not going to change their minds. And speaking as somebody who was in that world for quite a long time, facts often don't change people's minds, actually, or scientific arguments. What pulls their hearts does. So pull people's hearts, but make sure you do it on the basis of facts, I should hasten to say, in tune with everything else I've said this evening. But appeal to what we... Make people fall in love with the creation, and they'll respond to it differently.
Somebody over there. Doesn't somebody want to ask the question whether telling a lie is ever required or justified?
On here.
Sorry, there's a lady there. So sorry.
I have a question, but it's not that one.
You ask your question, please. Oh, hello.
My name is Carol Taylor. I was listening to a minister speak. He was a former minister of education, and former minister of education, and he talked about a program that he had been advised to run to allow school children to visit universities in order to show them what a wonderful place university could be. This was quite a while ago. And he said that he was advised to have one group, that the scientific model would suggest that he should have had one group of children who were not allowed. And he said, if I do that, then I'm going to get... Well, I see you're nodding your head, so you know my question. No, how would a politician be wisely able to make that choice of, well, scientifically, I really ought to leave some children out, a group, and yet the criticism that would be likely to occur if
indeed
he did that?
And they would be wrong too. If you have some notion that an intervention is going to do good, to prove that your intervention has done good by denying a control group that intervention would be unethical. And that's well recognized in medical research too. So there are trial designs where there is a known treatment. You don't have a placebo arm. You don't have an arm where nobody receives the treatment. You just design the trial in such a way that you can still be sure of getting some kind of a reliable response or answer with a group that has an intervention. You simply design the trial differently, and there are ways to do that. Or your research might be population-based, for example, or qualitative.
I mean, this minister was speaking,
yes, but that's
would
a very...
Would you mind awfully... I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Would you mind standing up? Because at the back, you're difficult to be heard.
I was just saying that...
Sorry to come back. I was just saying that the minister framed, you know, you were just saying there are ways around this. This minister said, you know, politically, that model wasn't going to work for the children who were not allowed to be in this program.
Right, and politically wouldn't work for good reason because it would be unethical. So he simply had a very narrow model of what science is, in my opinion, there.
Gentlemen there, please. And then I'll come to the very, very back. Not next. First gentleman here, fourth row.
I'm Gordon Brett, just humble association member. I was tempted to ask you how many Christians it took to change a light bulb, but I'll skip over that very quickly. I just wonder, one thought I had about your lecture which sprung to mind was the whole question of whistleblowing and whether there was something in that that we could look at. At the moment, the whistleblower literally almost gets crucified, if that's the right expression in this context. But I wonder if there could be more done in the sense of whistleblowing and the concept of it and encouraging it much more than we have at the moment.
Oh, most certainly there could. A culture in which it's perfectly all right to point out that the emperor is wearing no clothes is a culture we would all want to live in, it seems to me. And some public service institutions are making great efforts in this regard. And the Chilcot report was very useful. So the Chilcot report has this concept of the Chilcot person who is there precisely to see the opposite of the way everybody else is looking, because it recognises that this notion of groupthink, or this way in which we can be biased by each other, or it's not even necessarily that you'd be afraid to speak out, it's just that you don't see what might be obvious to somebody who's trying to look from a different perspective. But it's a matter of evolving a culture within which that happens, and that comes out of trust of each other. So with one's friends, one can do that. With people one knows aren't going to come back at you, one can do that. So power relations are very important in that context. But it's the ethos within which people are operating that makes that possible. We don't want too many public service institutions where good people are required to be heroes. And there's too much of that at the moment. It shouldn't be heroic to tell the truth. It should be normal.
Thank you.
The lady at the very back, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was incredibly inspiring. I do want to know the answer to Lord Judge's question, actually, but wondered if I could slip in another question as well. Throughout this series, we've looked at the negative role of social media and the technological sort of revolution of recent years. The converse to that is that it does make policies and materials and opinions more accessible to a wider range of people who wouldn't have had access to traditional forms, both in this country and also in developing countries. How can we harness this new power, particularly in relation to youth and as yet, groups who haven't accessed power traditionally, how can we harness it and make sure it's used positively to find truth?
Thank you. Intentionally is the answer. So I think there's, and it might be a generational thing, I think there's a certain amount of fear about this extraordinary power, for example, of big data, of the way in which technology can do so much and so fast and so comprehensively. And there's a certain fear of the technology itself. I think we, as human beings who can discern and judge and choose rightly, need to do that really intentionally with the digital world, with the possibilities of technology. Technology needs a good goal to be aimed at, and then my goodness will it deliver. Terrifically it will deliver. But it needs that goal to be set for it. And I fear that without that really intentional setting of the goal, its own power will take us over and it will gain its own momentum, which I think is rather what's happened within social media and with the use of Facebook and so forth. It's because we can, we do it, whereas we should be thinking, what good thing that would serve all of us can we do with this extraordinary power?
Sorry, lady, the nearest lady to me, that's six rows behind. Yes. And then I'll come to the lady in front of you, please. Sorry.
My name is Catherine Pepinster, and thank you, Claire, particularly because I'm a journalist, for saying good things about journalism. But I think when it comes to journalism, people have to bear in mind that journalists aren't necessarily going after one single abstract truth. You began with Richmond Crompton, and we all found what she had to say about William very amusing. And, of course, she was writing, although we think of those stories as being for children, she first wrote for adults, actually. And the audience that you have as a writer and as a journalist really affects what the truth is when you tell your story. And journalists don't sit around saying, I'm going to tell the truth, they say, I'm going to write a story. And I think that really affects how we deal with facts and with the truth. If I just take a very abstract theoretical example to explain it, if there was a fire in Berkhamsted which affected the dental surgery of a world-famous dentist developing amazing new techniques, and his wife was a grower of dahlias, the story in the Berkhamsted paper would be very different to the one in the dental journal that told you all about how the world-famous surgery was affected, and the story in Amateur Gardener about the world-famous collection of dahlias that were trampled on by the fire brigade would be different again. I mean, it's a slightly silly example, but it shows that the people for whom you write, the context in which you write, affects how the truth is told. So your audience is as important as the facts that you're delivering.
That's absolutely true, and I think you've just given a demonstration of what good journalism can be like. You're not straying from the facts, but you're telling the story on the basis of the facts that is relevant for different audiences. I think one of the difficulties with social media and increasing technology is that you write something and it enters the ether, and all sorts of audiences will read it. And it may be therefore misunderstood or misread or mistaken in some way. And that's a difficulty. It's something I've thought about a bit, actually. You must have done also as a journalist. I thought about who my audience was when I wrote this lecture. And it would have been a different lecture with a different audience, I guess. Although I think perhaps one of the challenges of technology is to think, well, supposing absolutely anybody heard this story or heard what I had to say, how would it stand? And also thinking into the future as well. Westminster Abbey Institute thinks in 1,000-year cycles, so what we say now has to hold firm for a long time.
Thank you. Now the lady in front of the last questioner, please.
Thank you. Sarah Delamere. What do you think comes more naturally to human beings, telling the truth or telling lies? Mm-hmm.
I think telling lies. That's why we have to work at it. And it's a very human thing. In fact, it's one of the examples of things that apparently humans do that computers can't do, when we try to work out what's left when computers can do so much. One of the things is lying. And there's a wonderful character, Lyra, in the Philip Pullman series, his Dark Materials, and her great fame is that she can lie. And what it really means is she can tell a really, really good story.
Next question, please.
What it means is we have to work at telling the truth and tell the truth beautifully and well, so the stories are just as compelling but truthful.
Gentlemen, almost in the middle there, please. There. And then I'll come to the lady in front of you.
Good evening. Thank you for the insightful lecture. I do believe that truth-telling is a muscle that we need to work on. But my question would be, do you think truth would ever become damaging at some point, and hence it should not be told? Thank you.
Yes. So this is your question. I do not believe that the truth is damaging. I believe there are ways of telling it. There are times to tell it. There are times not to tell it. But I do not believe that it's damaging. And I say that sometimes when we hear something that's very hard to hear. For example, we might hear that someone we love or even ourselves have a terminal illness. That is very, very hard to hear. But if you face it, it becomes extraordinarily empowering. And that can be the effect of truth. But choose your moment. Find your way of telling it.
And the lady in front. Thank you.
Elizabeth Morse, you talked about medicine taking time to discern what the truth is in a particular treatment. I wish it was always like that, I'm not sure. But on the other hand, you also talked about the artist. Mm. And I'm thinking about poetic truth, about artistic truth, which isn't given that kind of testing. It's just an instinctive, whether it's based on experience, insight, whatever, okay, insightful truth, which doesn't have that kind of testing, and doesn't necessarily have that time. It may just be.
Indeed.
It's not quite a question, but I'm finding it a bit of a sort of, does truth always have to be, take such time to be tested?
Well, there's insight, isn't there, an inspiration when something suddenly is, as it were, visited upon you, or something becomes clear to you. So Archimedes Eureka in the bath, or when he was running naked through the streets, the story depends who tells the story. which is true. So there's a moment of realization, or a seed. There's something that happens very quickly. It then might need to be very carefully tested. Actually, it depends what it is. Even an artist will take time then, perhaps, to express that extraordinary insight through a painting or a poem. That can take a long time, even if the thing itself was very immediate, the heart of it was very immediate. And indeed, the discovery of a new treatment can begin with some sort of extraordinary realization that seems to come from nowhere. I think Einstein was very articulate on this, that your mind is open to the heavens, some new way of seeing or responding occurs to you, and then you have to test it out. But the point about the medical model, the medical research model, really is to say this is an approach to discovery and to implementation which has all the humility of the person who's never going to assume they've got the final answer, but is simply learning. And we talk about lifelong learning, don't we? Talk about an attitude where you've never closed with the truth, you've never assumed that you've got it, and there's nothing after the it. There's always more to learn, and there's always something that can be refined about what you've seen. That's our human existence. It's always partial, and there's always more. Thank goodness, otherwise wouldn't it be boring if we didn't have more to discover? And patiently.
I'll take one more gentleman there. Oh, it's made again, too. Do you mind if I take
this? I don't mind, but we might need a glass of wine.
Well, make it a short question. So.
Jonathan Todd, on your fellowship programme, as you know, as a lawyer, we try and look at things perhaps a bit more simply. And some years ago, in preparing my client to give evidence,
would you mind awfully raising your voice? You're difficult to be heard.
Certainly. Preparing my client to give evidence, he said to me, so, you know, what should I say? You know, what's the best thing to say? And I said to him, just tell the truth, because the truth is easy. Lying becomes complicated. And he said to me, so which truth is that? And my question for you is the truth complicated? Is the truth easy?
Mm. I think the truth might be complex. I don't think it's complicated. So there may be... So if we think about ecological systems, they're very complex, but they're not complicated. I don't think the truth is easy. No, I don't.
Hmm. One last question for the lady here in the second row. Thank you.
I don't normally do this. My name's Teresa Reed. I just wondered whether, instead of saying we respect other people or we need friends who respect us or we can trust these people to support us, we can learn, maybe, and that's hard, learn to trust ourselves first, respect ourselves first, and at the end of the day, is it about being true to ourselves as a starting point?
Definitely. But we also need to guard against being so true to ourselves that we simply ignore the world around us. Being human is being human among other human beings. And that means you will have a sense of integrity, you will have a sense of what your own conscience, your own truth is. But you must always speak it out, share it, and be ready to learn more from others, to be porous, in other words, to the company that you're in. Otherwise, that integrity can become quite a selfish and narrow thing. You can say, I know what the truth is, I know what I should be doing, and damn the rest of you. And that's not a good way to be, I suggest.
I was thinking the opposite, which is it makes us very vulnerable.
To
be ourselves.
Oh, yes. Hence the need for good company. We do need to trust ourselves. And we need to be ready to be vulnerable, but we need to be in good company when we are. Certainly.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry, I've got to bring this to an end. I don't want to bring it to an end. The subject, we have all night. These are issues which will go on. These issues go on through eternity. That's the short answer to them. We have to address them in every generation. If I may, don't let's worry too much about modern technology. When Gutenberg invented the printing press, we didn't all think, but a whole lot of people thought this was a dreadful moment. And indeed, you can argue very strongly, led to a lot of bloodshed because people took different views about the faith and what the Bible said. But in the end, this new technology will be available to us for ourselves to use in an appropriate way. I'm not frightened by it. I don't think we should ever be frightened by new things. But the eternal verity, that's not frightening either. I think what we've listened to tonight has been a most stimulating but profoundly thought-provoking lecture from Dr. Moving. I found it moving in a personal way too, which I think some of you did as I was observing you. I think that it brings the end to this series of addressing the issue of truth in this holy place. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.